Yes, we are very happy that you are present.
I am very happy, and I sort of learned a lot from the morning session. And I was listening to the morning session, and I was wondering, where do I begin? You know, where do I begin my understanding of intersectionality? And it was interesting, from the doctoral students, they're very different kind of work, many of them focusing on questions of migration and citizenship. And I was wondering, again, what do I speak on? Because I come from the other part of the world, and some of the issues which are being raised here in the contemporary context are not exactly the issues which were raised there, but there are parallels and similarities. And so I would begin somewhere from my own journey of how I started doing women's studies and the issues which I encountered. But first I have to begin with a confession that I learnt of this particular concept, intersectionality, very, very recently. And I learnt that I was somebody who did intersectional analysis even more recently when I got Christine's letter saying that I'm somebody who's done intersectional analysis. I begin on that note for a particular reason, which would link up with the title of my talk, that did Indian feminist writers have any choice but to be intersectional, and then recognizing theory. That we in the South are not very sure about what theory we use, or are we theoretical? In my work on feminism in India, I was supposed to do a conceptual history of the term feminism in India, and everybody told me that Indian feminists didn't theorize. Indian feminists just did developmental work, you know, because people are poor and you need developmental work. So we never had any theory. So I had to sort of rethink both the concept of theory and why we understand it in a particular way, and why, in hindsight, now that I know I do intersectional analysis, why we had no choice but to be intersectional. I begin from the time I started my doctoral work, which was on the Indian women's movement in the colonial period. And a lot of people told me that your work, this is late 1970s when there was what we call the second phase of the women's movement in India. And people told me, but what is the women's movement in this? It's all about male social reformers. It's all about male leaders. Where is the women in your story? There is no women here, you know. Where is the women's subjectivity? Where is the women's autonomy? Where is the women's selfhood? And I would get very confused, because I would still think that there was a story there, but I did not have the theoretical language to express it. So I would try to say, yes, I'm trying to write on the women's movement, its relationship to the national movement, and I'm trying to link up the national movement with questions of colonialism, and I'm trying to work out the manner in which communities are being constructed in colonial India, and how gender was being used, because I had no other way but to study it like this. And I'll give you concrete examples to illustrate what I meant by this. The earliest gender issue, or what we call the women's issue, which cropped up in India, was the question of sati, which you would be familiar was for Hindu upper caste widows in particular regions, when they for their husband died, the idea was that they had no longer any right to live, and you were forcibly, you know, you died on the pyre of your husband. And there was a lot of debate about sati. Is it Hindu? Is it not Hindu? Is it right? Is it wrong? What does it do to the rights or autonomy of women? Is it our culture? Is it not our culture? And the discourse, there were divisions within reformers, there was writings, treatises, petitions to the colonial state, some saying, yes, Sati is wrong, but who is the colonial state to tell us it is wrong? When we become independent, we'll do something about it, you know. That the community has the right to intervene, not the state, you know. We had others, conservative elements from the community. I'll give you two examples. There was a social reform movement which was campaigning against Sati called Brahmo Samaj, and they went to the British and said that, look, Sati is wrong, it's anti-human, it's illegal, and you have to ban it. And 1829, the British state decided to ban it. On the other hand, you had a conservative group, which were called Dharma Sabha, that is in defense of religion, who went to the British state and said, we have no problem with your rule, we like the British, we like colonialism, everything you do is perfectly in order, as long as you don't intervene in our customs, in what we do to our women. And we'll support you, you stay off. So right from the beginning, when we started discussing the women's question in India, we had to be intersectional. There was no way we could discuss it without the question of community, without the question of the state, without the question of colonialism. But feminist theories changed. So in the late 1970s and 1980s, when you had another kind of dominant feminist theory, there's this very famous article by an Indian feminist called Lata Mani, whatever, you know, where you talk about the Sati discourse, says that, what was this discourse about on Sati? Was it about women? It wasn't about women. It was about religion. It was about culture. It was about tradition. It was about community. Where is the women? And they would again, people would go back and say, but it was about women because Sati was stopped. And once the reformers took up the question of women's education, widow remarriage, even if they had very patriarchal visions of recasting a new bourgeois, Western model domesticated woman, when reforms take place, it has a logic which extends beyond the paradigm from which that reform was formulated. So you may say, we want now women to be educated, but we don't want them to be too much educated. We want them just equipped in cookery, domestic work. We want them to be smart, teach their children mathematics, learn more Western concepts of sanitation. But once women started being educated, they couldn't be stopped. There's always a logic which extends beyond the creators of that framework. And the very good example is Gandhi, because Gandhi was very, very vocal about women coming out into the streets, opposing colonial rule. And he was very inspiring in drawing out women from their homes into the public and political sphere. But when he launched what was called the Salt Ban Movement, that is a protest march against the British because they would levy tax on the salt, and they wanted a march towards the seashore where you just picked up salt from the sea and said that, look, we have a right to make our own salt. He said this may be dangerous and the police would come in, so it is better that women don't come. And the women said, but you told us that we can come and we are coming whether you like it or not. So we had a kind of world where this issue of womanhood, issue of colonial rule, issue of nationalism, and issues of different communities within the country were being articulated at the same time. You know, it was something which you simply could not separate. I'll give you again a concrete example. One of the early women's organizations called All India Women's Conference was established in 1926. And in the constitution of the women's organization, they said we will not have anything to do with politics because if we get involved in politics, it's going to be dangerous for our social reform and educational agenda for women. And once they began, they found that it was impossible not to engage in politics. Some of their members were imprisoned because they were opposing the British. And they changed their constitutional provision and said that now we have to be, because unless the country is free, women cannot be free. So the nation's freedom is inextricably linked to women's freedom. So again, you bring out that we had no choice but to make these linkages. The question got more complicated when the question arose, okay, the nation has to be free and only then women can be free, but who is the nation? because India is intrinsically diverse and plural, you know. So you don't have one homogeneous community. So while the Indian community, hypothetically, if you bracket India, they said, we must be different from the colonial rulers. We have our distinct identity. We have our tradition. That's one kind of tension between the state and the community. The other tension was that there were many communities. So you had, at the same time, during the colonial period, the Hindu community becoming more organized and more self-conscious as a community, and the Muslim community becoming more organized and self-conscious as a community, and you had various caste groups also becoming more self-conscious and organized. I use this word self-conscious because recent scholars suggest that, of course, there were always communities in India, multiple communities, different religions, different castes, different tribes. But with the coming in of colonial rule, the boundaries of these communities became more solid and fixed. The state moved in to count how many Hindus there are, how many Muslims there are, how many castes there are, who belongs to which caste. So there was a logic by which the governmental policies brought in a certain dynamism that you had to mark yourself out, that this is who we are. And the critique is that before the colonial rule, there was a lot of syncretic practices. And you would have common practices between groups of Hindus and Muslims because the unit was local. You may have a common shrine in a village where both communities would go and worship. But you were not marked that I am a Hindu and there are so many Hindus in this world, or I am a Muslim and there are so many Muslims in that world. That modern imagination did not exist. But in the 19th century, just as we were trying to become modern and have modern notions of justice, women's rights, independent rights, citizenship rights, modern ideas of autonomy and sovereignty, we are also trying to articulate at the same time that yes, we are Indians, but we are also Hindus, and we are also Muslims, and we are also upper caste, and we are also lower caste. So it grew together. The women's issue did not ever emerge independent of the dynamics of nationhood and the multiple visions of who constituted that nation. Is it going to be a Muslim nation? Is it going to be a Hindu nation? Is it going to be a secular nation? What happens? And I'll give you another example when there was the suffragette movement and we wanted the right to vote. And since we were a colonial country, the idea was, of course, everybody's right to vote. It's not that the men had any right to vote either. And there was a particular policy called the communal award, which the colonial state brought about. The women's movement's position was that all women have the right to vote, and the women's right to vote should not be linked with representational questions of community. But the British state thought it better to have a communal award where they had reserved constituencies for different communities. So you would have Muslim representation, you would have this. Muslim members within women's organizations like All India Women's Conference opposed this and said, I mean, the particular metaphor they used is, we are all women in saris. How does it matter who we are? And we're oppressed similarly. But the same kind of tensions had already started emerging from more conservative Muslim organizations. They said, no, if you take this position of women being represented on their own terms, on gender basis, this is going to weaken our community presence in the nation or in the forthcoming state. So finally, this was a particular Begum of Bhopal, who was an All India Women's Conference, they decided to walk out and defend the community award. So you had the women's organizations way back, like I said, it's almost 100 years back, where they had to negotiate with the question, should we be represented as unmarked women, or should we be represented as community members? And the issue, the more problematic aspect was, who would define what the community was all about? Who would decide that? Is parda part of our culture? Is parda not part of our culture? Is widow remarriage prohibited in the Hindu community? Is it not? It was always obviously the more conservative, patriarchal sections of the community who would decide that this is your culture or this is your community. this was also a point of time where traditions were in a certain sense being reinvented. Because earlier on, traditions were fluid. We did not know, the whole notion of an imagined nation, so to say, was emerging. So the idea that all Hindu women are supposed to be like this was a new concept which was emerging. Because earlier, if somebody asked somebody, who are you? They wouldn't say, I'm Hindu or I'm Indian or I'm Muslim. They would probably refer to the community and the village they belonged to, which was a micro detail, and would say, I come from so-and-so lineage, from so-and-so caste, from that so-and-so village. But you did have a notion of a monolithic Hindu identity or a monolithic Muslim identity, which was cutting across genders and classes. But this is the time when this emergence of this was happening. And I was mentioning just the other day at Geneva, a good example is the question of parda, where there was debates on parda in the 19th century in India. And the Hindu social reformers said that parda was a Muslim innovation, and they brought it with them from outside. So the Hindu women who practice parda should just get rid of it because it's a Muslim custom. And the Muslim social reformers in the 19th century very interestingly said that parda is a very old-fashioned and a traditional practice which Hindu women practice, and no Muslim women in Central Asia or Middle East practice parda, you know, so we should get rid of it. So right from the beginning, the gender issue was caught between communities and between the state and community. It was not one. And the state had a big role in recreating and reinventing what was supposed to be gender practices of different communities. And again, a concrete example may help. Before the British state took over directly in 1857, they actually conquered parts of India in 1757, and you had the East India Company already there. And they wanted to know more about these people they were going to rule because they were so diverse, many cultures. So the East India Company had this system whereby which they wanted to codify the customs and practices which different communities practiced. And so they would invite people. So they would invite, say, the Hindu priest or a Muslim scholar or a practicing priest, and tell them, okay, what is your practice? Do you believe in child marriage? Okay, yes, no, whatever your customs are. And this would be written down, and then they would be put forward as the customs of the people. And this always led to considerable difficulty and paradoxes. And again, an example may help to bring this out. Like I was just saying, there was widespread control and very difficult circumstances for widows in India among particular communities. So widows were prohibited from remarrying. There were child widows. Widows were oppressed. There were extremely humiliating social customs to curb the widows. And there was this reform movement which demanded that widows should be remarried, should have the right to remarry. And finally, the British state responded, and they brought up this Widow Remarriage Act in the 1860s. And once they brought out the Widow Remarriage Act, they felt everybody should be very happy because now widows could get remarried. But that's not how the story took place, because you had instead a lot of cases being filed in different courts by women who were widows and who had remarried, who argued among our communities, the customary law always allowed us to remarry. And when we remarried under our customary law, we were also allowed to retain our property and the children by the first marriage. But this new law which you have brought about to make women free actually inhibits us from doing this. So the codification of law, which was based on information on a particular section of society, was then imposed on the others, who felt this codified and more liberated law was actually much more oppressive, you know. So we had a system by which the women's issue emerged in a kind of crucible where you had the state action, you had communities operating and contesting each other's, and you had the women's question emerging right amidst this. So what we had a question was that the point that I was trying to make, that feminists in our part of the country never had a choice but to be intersectional. though we did not know that the term here was intersectional. In fact, the critique for many of our writings, often by both Western feminists and Indian feminists who were trained in the West, was that Indian feminists are so abashed and hesitant to talk about their own personal lives, you know. And they're very happy to talk about rural women, peasant women, agricultural laborers, factory workers, Dalit women. But why don't they talk about their own selves and their own angsts, you know? And they saw this as a poorer version of what a good women's movement would be. And we would be all a little sort of hesitant, you know, because they would say. So I was... for a long time in the mode where people would say, but you're talking about class and you're talking about nationalism and you're talking about the state, where is the woman? And then suddenly the world changes in this part of the world because you have a different political and economic environment, the question of immigration, question of assertions, question of fundamentalism, and it comes back in fashion, you know, and like again a particular term. So here was like the other thing which struck me when I was listening in this morning, that what is intersectionality? I mean, if I have to read back into my empirical and historical accounts and say, what is it, you know? That I find, and I may be completely wrong, and I stand corrected if that is so, that very often when you suggest intersectionality and you say there's race, there must be gender, and there's class, the assumption is it's always the others who have the race, who have the class, and who have the gender. The dominants are unmarked in the sense that do you have to be black and do you have to be a woman to have the markers? I mean, is it not to be marked if you're white, or in India if you're upper caste or Hindu? I mean, you're equally marked. But it's the minority communities which tend to be, you know. So I would find myself, again, returning from where I begin, because I belong to the dominant community in my country. I'm the majority community I represent. And yet, for even the majority community in the non-West world, you had no option but to be intersectional. So that's a very different story from seeing intersectionality emerging only when the issue is about a minority community. You know, because I was sort of struck by this, and I was wondering how do we sort of negotiate that. I go back with certain kind of examples because that may be simpler. I mentioned sati, and I showed you about how different communities. I mentioned widow remarriage. And again, I brought in, you know, what were the dynamics. And I now move a little more, maybe I give you another example, again to show very similar tensions which are present in the Western world today. Upper caste Hindu women were often married off before puberty. That was supposed to be a custom, you know, that the father of the child maybe goes to heaven or something, that before she reaches puberty, she should be given off in marriage. And there was some terrible stories about these little child brides. There was somebody called Phulmoni who was actually killed, you know, on consummation. And there was this demand by social reformers to what they wanted to raise the age of consummation, and they called it the Age of Consent Bill. And at this, in 2010, it may seem absurd here to say they were trying to raise the age from 11 to 12 or 12 to 13, you know, something like this. And the Age of Consent Bill was in the 1890s. And the world had changed dramatically from 1829, when the sati was banned, when everybody wanted to become modern and ask the state to intervene, except small groups like Dharma Sabha, to the 1890s, when the anti-colonial movement had become very, very strong, and nationalist ideas had spread all over the country. And when the social reformers went to the colonial state and said, you have to intervene and raise the age of marriage for Hindu women, a lot of social reformers who actually believed in that said, okay, but we'll do that. Who's the British state to tell us when our daughters should get married? And they gave some interesting examples, which again can be very illuminating in the present context, that at that point of time when a lot of indigenous labor from India were being sent off to Latin America, African colonies for sugarcane plantation work, and they would be bundled up in ships and sent, and there would be times when many, many hundreds of them died And the Indian nationalists went to the British state and kept asking them to stop this or to regulate this migration of indentured laborers. And the British state just turned a deaf ear. So the reformers and the nationalist argument is that they don't do anything to all the famines which are taking place, to the plagues which are taking place, to the complete economic devastation which the country is facing, to the plight of the indentured laborers, then who are they to tell us when our daughters get married? You know, and you had the entire country divided, including reformers who are extremely committed to gender justice, saying that no, this state has no right to intervene in questions of our personal matters. You know, so this was another marker. My early work was on this, the emergence of the women's question in India and its intersections with questions of nationality, state, community. And later, I took up a particular document which may be of great interest to you, that India became independent in 1947. But the national movement was very strong, and you had a very strong economic nationalist ideology even during the freedom movement. And 1938, which is almost a decade before India became independent, the Indian National Congress, which was leading the national movement, instituted a committee called National Planning Committee. And it had 29 subcommittees. And the idea was to map a vision of how India would develop after independence. And what is most significant, that of those 29 subcommittees, which was on petroleum, agriculture, land reform, rural development, there was one whole subcommittee on women, which was called The Role of Women in a Planned Economy, which is almost 300 pages. And it's probably the first status document of women, and then what did women do in India. What is very, very interesting, and again to show to you the complexity of the situation over there, earlier on, the issues which were being raised in 19th century were upper caste, middle class women, sati, widow remarriage, age of consent, child marriage. 1938, this document makes a complete departure because you have to be maybe familiar that the Indian National Movement had very diverse ideological trends. It had a strand which was very influenced by Western democratic ideas and liberalism. It had a strand which was extremely influenced by the socialist visions and the model of development in the Soviet Union at that point of time. And it had a vision which was also an assertion of its cultural pride and its ancient past. So you had a very peculiar combination. And in this work that I did on the 1938 plan document is a text analysis, and I called it Citizen Worker Cultural Emblems, an analysis of the document, because women were seen as citizens. That was one vision. Women were seen primarily as productive workers. You know, the whole socialist vision where the woman, whenever you saw the Indian woman, it would be the factory worker. I don't know whether you all are familiar with Hindi films, but a lot of them, you're pulling the plow, you know, you're working in the field, you're in a factory. So that is another model. And the third model is something which has happened to many colonial countries, where you felt humiliated with a colonial state which told you you are barbaric, you are savage, you had the most obscure practices that could be, to assert that no, you know, we have a tradition which is longer, older, so you have a vision of a golden past, which may not have been so golden, but there was a reinvented tradition that we had a past which is different. In fact, my first name is the name of one of the women who was supposed to have written the Vedas, you know. So there was this notion that you have empowered women of that period, and Hinduism is not only about burning women, but Hinduism is about women scholars and women philosophers and women mathematicians. So you had all these three strands, you know, coming in. Which brings me to the other aspect of our intersectionality. And that's something which I have addressed in my introduction to feminism in India, that we had no choice not to be intersectional. We also had no choice but to engage with the West. The West had a choice not to engage with us. They lived in a world where it was possible to have all the feminist debate, you know, unhappy marriage, of Marxism, feminism, domestic labor. You could do it all here, self-contained, and not have to engage. We had no such choice, you know. We had to constantly engage with the West, because our entry into modernity is through colonialism. We had no other language. So the question which in the morning I liked very much when you said about co-existence, that can you separate? In our case, we could not separate. Are we modern? Invariably linked to the question, are we Western? Because there was the modernity was Western, and modernity came through colonialism. So we had an ambiguous relationship, a conflicting relationship with the West. So when I started my work on the conceptual history of feminism, a lot of people said that Indian feminists kept saying we are not feminists. So all our social reformers and nationalists, including our Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, would say, I'm not a feminist. You know, big social reformers would say, I'm not a feminist, we're not like the Western feminists, you know. And at first reading, most people would take that as something like a compromise with patriarchy. You know, okay, you don't want to say that. Or they would say they're obscure, or they would say it's an anti-Western thing, you know. Or they would basically say that if they're not feminists, they're not feminists. But when I was doing the conceptual history, I felt there was more to this story than this, because they were incredible women. They were women who did not mind going to jails for not 1 year, 2 years, sometimes 10 years. They were women who had broken all traditions. And if they were saying something like that, I felt they were trying to say something else. And my reading was that that was a time when the language of difference was still not legitimate within the academic world, you know. And they were probably articulating a language of difference in a time when theoretically you did not have an accepted language of multiculturalism and difference, you know. A difference in an earlier time meant backward. You lagged behind. It didn't mean that you were something different. So they were probably reinventing a certain kind of language to express their discomfiture, that they could not express themselves the same way as the Western woman did. So, but they did not have the standard concepts which are so readily available to us within the academia today to express what we did. So the other question of intersectionality, apart from community, nation, state, colonialism, was our international connections. There was no time at modernity when we didn't have to engage with these questions of our relationship with the United States, or our relationship with the Soviet Union, our relationship with Latin America. That was part of our history. Which women were we like, you know? And like, we had absolutely no question of choice about this. The other question that comes up in a very differentiated society like ours, which is both culturally different and unequal, is the concept of multiple patriarchies, you know. The question that was often raised in India was, how come in India you don't have the kind of struggle on domestic division of labor which took place in the second phase of the women's movement in the West? Who will wash the plates, or who will do this? And the answer is quite simple. In a very unequal society, and that's where the morning session talks about, the ready availability of domestic workers, where neither the man nor the woman really has to engage in many of these works, it's possible to have caregivers who are outside the family system. But the more difficult question here by multiple patriarchies is that for the upper caste woman, when she's resisting certain patriarchal practices, she's not just resisting her husband or her boyfriend. She's resisting a set of customs and social institutions and practices which stretch beyond the husband or the boyfriend. You know, that is the notion of selfhood. Our notions of selfhood are extremely relational. Who are we? You know, how autonomous are we? Is all connected with where we come from, our caste, our community, our family, our lineage. You know, it's complicated. What is also a problem is, and this story is much more similar to the Black Women's Movement, is the women from the lower castes, where they want to fight for their rights, and they have to face what is called multiple patriarchies, because they have to face the patriarchy within their community, within their family, and they have to face a larger unequal caste structure where the patriarchy of the other dominant caste also impinges upon them. This is something, there have been some wonderful work, again taking the case of widowhood, to explain how oppressive customs of upper caste widows have to be understood in connection with both reproduction of caste inequality and gender inequality. And I'll just briefly dwell on this. That traditionally, upper caste women, who would be basically landed women, their husbands would be landed, or the men of the family would be landed, there was great sexual control over them. You know, they were supposed to not move out, mobility was restricted, they were married very early, they always seemed to be in danger that supposing something terrible happens. And they would be the reproducers of the heirs of that property or heirs of the land, and the man had to be absolutely sure that this son is mine and no else, you know. And so you had complete control over the woman's movement, and extremely violent methods by ensuring that the woman stays pure and sexually, you know, chaste. In contrast, when you come down the ladder, the women, the Dalit women, would be at the bottom and would be normally landless, would be supposed to be sexually free. And the landlord would actually have access to sexual favors from the woman right at the bottom. So the extreme sexual control over the woman at the top, extreme hardship and penance for her when she is widowed, and what was seen as the sexual laxity of the women below, was linked to the whole question of multiple patriarchies. So the man at the top had control over his women, over his wife, and he had control of the women of his laborers' wives too. So this was a system by which, so customs like widowhood could not be understood only vis-a-vis the husband, or only vis-a-vis the custom, or only vis-a-vis culture, but had to be understood with the overall social institution of land, land production, caste, and how that was interlinked. And this is something which continues to be part of our world today in our country. Rape, the issue of rape, which was so big in most countries here, and which was taken up in a big way in India after the 70s, it was differently looked at. Rape was, of course, always possible. But the idea was that not it was not a question of rape of a woman just by any man here and there. But rape in India always had a systemic aspect to it. That is, more women from the more vulnerable sections were raped. Rape was often used as an instrument of dominance and assertion of hegemony by the dominant community on the others. So even today, when you have a riot between different communities, the dominant communities or the police force would rape women of the minority community to teach them a lesson. The partition in 1947, when India and Pakistan were separated, the whole issue was not just a property loss, loss of land, loss of territory, huge tragedy, but the issue of rape was huge. Because the idea that the enemy community's women had to be raped for you to assert yourself. So rape in our countries always had an aspect of contestation of power between communities and assertions of not only patriarchal assertions, but assertions of who calls the shots, you know, which community is stronger. You know. So again, when we go to questions of violence against women, physical violence against women like rape, we find that it's not possible to discuss it except bringing in questions of community, questions of caste, and even questions of ethnicity. Because we have a very, very ethnically diverse country, and very often in ethnic conflicts in the Northeast, rape has been something which has been repeatedly emerging, you know, where you feel that those women who belong to those other communities could be raped and you could sort of get away with it. This kind of approach, like I sort of, if I can quickly do a small recap of what I was trying to argue is that right from the beginning, we entered modernity, we entered even modern language of citizenship rights and women's rights only through the language of the West, which for us was ambiguous, both liberating, offering us possibilities of reclaiming our rights, and at the same time hegemonic, and somebody who has been humiliating you and has been taking up cases selectively. So we won't intervene in many issues, but we'll intervene in gender issues, you know. So there was always this kind of mixed reaction to Western intervention. The other aspect is, this is one vis-a-vis the state. The other is the state's relationship to different communities. When did the state decide to play up one community against the other? When did they decide the Hindus are better than the Muslims? When did they decide the Muslims are better than the Hindus? This was something which we, so it was part of the state practice of the colonial state. And their administrative measures by which people got marked and got fixed, you know, into categories. Because the argument is we've always had this diversity, but it was very fluid. I'll give you an example. There was a People of India project done not too long ago in the 1970s, where a large number of people, when asked who were they, said they were both Hindus and Muslims. And that group is obviously not the literate group. Because the more literate you became, the more fixed your boundaries became, you know. And the more you're aware you were, okay, you know, I am so-and-so, and there are so many of us in the country, and we are soon going to be run over, or we are soon going to run others over. With the, you know, this kind of modernist vision which came about was something which was not present there. So the fixity of categories is something which did come, which is not to say that there were no categories before, but that it acquired a dynamism of its own, you know, where this became an issue by which you could contest. And then I mentioned the influence of socialist ideas in the mainstream nationalist movement in our country, where we had a very strong notion of a vision of the worker. Like I said, the first plan document is the working class women and the peasant women who represents the nation, with the cultural emblems of the nation. But that representation changed later on, from the 1990s, when the government of India changed its economic policies and opted for a more integrated economy in the global economy and perceived itself as, you know, embarking on a new journey of new liberal economic policies. Very interestingly, because that's another area of my work, representation of women began to change. And the cultural icons of the nation were no longer the peasant or the working class women, but were increasingly the more upwardly mobile middle class women who were seen as the cultural emblems. And I'll give you a small example. You may not be familiar with this, but suddenly from the early 90s, Indian women started being declared Miss Universe, Miss World in all the global fashion things. You know, we had the same year, I think, Miss World and Miss Universe, Sushmita Sen and Aishwarya Rai, both film actresses now. And when they came to India, it is just amazing because it was so different from an earlier India. The president of the country received them, and they went into an open car drive of the first president of India, who was this austere Gandhian nationalist, because they were seen as the new ambassadors, the cultural ambassadors of India. And as the media kept emphasizing this new aspirational, modern, happening India, the vision of the working class and peasant women retreated not just from cultural representation in public media, but also from the model of economic development, you know, because it was turned around to argue earlier the worker and the peasant, at least representationally, was supposed to symbolize the productive capacities of the nation. And now it's the other way around. It's the ones who are the top who are supposed to be representing the nation, you know. So you have, I mean, I think the recent visit of President Obama or the Commonwealth Games is this new assertive India, where in the Commonwealth Games, they actually, we have a lot of very, very poor people. We have a lot of slums in Delhi, but they wanted this beautiful happening city to happen. So they chased away the poor. They literally, Delhi became an empty city, you know, because the beggars were all packed off in a train somewhere. The poor, the vendors went back to the villages because you didn't want to show your country in bad light, and you wanted to show all the beautiful people there. And this is something which has captured the crux of the new developmental framework. To return to intersectionality, therefore, it was not just a question of what particular issues of women or questions of sexuality of women and its control, but the centrality of gender in the developmental visions which were put forward by India and what happens, you know, here. I would stop here because probably in our discussion we could, you know, talk a little more about certain aspects of this. Thank you. Very, very strong movement against the use of rape in communal movements. In fact, one of the leading lawyers, human rights lawyers, who's been taking up the case of the Gujarat riot victims, you know, have taken this up in a major way. Most women's organizations have also taken it up. And the laws of rape and the kind of punishments which are going to be meted out. It's been done in a big way, but what happens with this community violence is a very strange thing. You have bursts of violence, and then people become completely savage, and they do terrible, terrible things, and they rape, and they murder, and they loot, and they burn, and you feel, are these the same people? And this goes away, and maybe a few months down the line, you see these people moving around completely, all right. You know, this has been pattern, something which has been very, very strange in the subcontinent, you know. It may be true here that did this happen here? Could it be possible that these perfectly nice-looking people had suddenly become so terribly violent? So it's not something where they're constantly waiting there to rape. That may have been easier. It's something which suddenly happens, and you have terrible things which start taking place, and then you again have. In fact, there have been some wonderful writings by feminist scholars on the partition victims, and they've actually interviewed men who are now really old, in their 80s, who have told them that they had raped women and they had done these terrible things, and they said, but we didn't know why, and they were perfectly nice looking old grandfathers who lived in these nice homes, and why did this happen? How did this happen? Was it planned, organized? Was there a leadership which was egging them on that you have to do it possible? You know, but your question is that how could it be prevented? Raises the question that if it was happening all the time, you know, then in community things, where it happens much more frequently is in the caste question. say in the villages, you know, where very often to punish an erring lower caste man, you rape the woman. But a very assertive movement has taken up that issue. In fact, there's greater and greater resistance to allow something like this. It's organized movements which alone could probably, you know, stop this from happening. At the same time, you have rape of another order, which is a more modern, you know, versions in the cities where you're anonymous. You know, you don't know who you are raping, but that is also there. But more traditionally, it's a systemic rape.
Yeah, thanks please. Very much. It was really dazzling. Overview.
Thank you.
A couple of just, I don't know exactly, again, whether it's a question, but what interested me was this sort of notion of the British sort of being very interested in the sort of classifications and categorizations of the cultures, and that seems to be an important part of the colonial project. You also see that, for example, in American colonialism in the Philippines, you know, the first thing of doing a census and sort of identifying all of these different tribes and cultures and classifications. And that seems to be sort of an important part of this somehow mastery or control over the population. So I'm just kind of interested in that kind of process. I'm not sure where to go with that, but it seems to be a kind of notion. And then I guess you had talked about the kind of dominant group being that somehow it's only like the woman of color who's like, you know, categorized as somehow experiencing intersectionality. Like she stands at this point, you know, of race and gender, and here she's standing there, you know, intersectional. And then the question is, well, you know, what about all the other people? Aren't they sort of intersectional? And I think one of the things that's really developed in the U.S., and I don't know whether that has developed, is sort of like critical whiteness studies, mm-hmm. of really trying to, you know, excavate what the meaning of whiteness and what the value is. As a matter of fact, I had talked before about property, actually an African-American legal scholar, woman, I've forgotten her name, does talk about whiteness as property within the kind of U.S. context, that sort of this notion of it being a kind of form of capital. For example, if you were somehow suspected of being part white, you would be
mocked.
You would lose your capital. Mm-hmm. I mean, that you would somehow, your capital would be
diminished.
So, like, you could sue somebody for maliciously accusing you, you know, of being black or something. And then, you know, there's also this kind of notion of whiteness always being constructed in contrast with other. And I don't know. Certainly in the colonial context, I think that is very important in terms of, I think that's why maybe the classification kind of comes in as a way of marking the other in order to kind of define yourself. Now, I don't know what happens to colonial societies within whatever you want to call it, the metropolis, whether that those kinds of colonial notions also then get travel to the center to also become part of that kind of identity. Because, you know, I've always argued that these kind of these relations are always, it's always relational. You know, like, it's not like here's the black and white, but there's always this kind of way in which the two things are interrelated in a very complex way. So I think that's another form of sort of looking at intersectionality is the sort of creation of these relational categories and identities.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, there's been a lot of work on this classification project. So, in fact, including the caste census. Right now, are we having a debate about the last caste census in India was done under the British in 1938. And in 1947, when we became independent, the idea was we drop it. It's a colonial project. But in 2010, we have demands by the more marginal castes or the aspirational castes that we need to be counted because, you know, they're making their stake claims in government and power structures. So caste census is probably going to be back. What is very, very interesting in India is the more progressive groups wanted a caste census where you correlate your caste identity with economic, social, cultural indicators, you know, so that you can have an affirmative policy which would reflect that whether how wealthy or how poor or how much access of resources you have. But the final version of the caste census which the government has come about with is just caste identity without any of those markers. So they don't want to really know how rich or poor you are. They just want to know how many are you, you know. So it's a strange way of reinventing these categories. But the British had, in fact, a very elaborate, process of categorizing. Some tribes and castes they declared as criminal. They were sort of notified criminal tribes. You know, many of them were nomadic communities, and I really don't know. There's been some wonderful work done on these communities, but once they were labeled criminals, it became very, very difficult for them to get out of that label. You know, though they were denotified after 1947, but it became something which was major. They also categorized some communities as martial races and some as effeminate races. So you had the Sikh community and the Sikh battalion saying that they come from the martial race, and so you have a whole notion of they're anyway a very patriarchal society with very strong notions of an aggressive masculinity, but the colonial state sort of buttressed this up even further, you know. And you had other communities who would then say this nation can only be saved by these martial races, you know, because the others were supposed to be effeminate and not as strong or valorous as these communities. So it went on at various dimensions, from race to degrees of feminization, to criminal and non-criminal. Yeah.
I noted that at some moment you mentioned how the fixity of categories, which is growing with modernity in a way, and isn't there also in your analysis a sort of question that is intersectionality a good question, or aren't we at the end contributing to constructing these and fixing categories?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question.
Maybe mise en scène, the performance of, we're not doing gender, but doing all these other categories.
I think we have to go.
Are we in the right way direction?
I think this is interesting because when we talk about intersectional analysis, and when I thought of myself doing intersectional analysis, I had thought more of categories like the state, categories like citizenship, categories like the nation, categories like the community. Whereas here it's often race, class, gender, and we could translate it and say caste and gender, you know. I think we have to be very careful about taking identity questions as givens. You know, that this is their identity forever. This is what they were forever. This is very, very difficult, because in South Asia, we see constantly that ideas have changed and ideas, identities have been reinvented. I mean, the most clear example is the case of Bangladesh, that in 1947, you have a whole country which breaks away on grounds of religion, saying that we are an Islamic country. 71, they break away, saying that they are firstly known by their ethnic community or language, Bengali, and therefore they break away. So you have, I mean, have these people changed? They're the same people. And their identities are, you know, reworked, resurfaces, and like I was mentioning yesterday, the state has even passed a, you know, an amendment going back to their first constitution, saying that they are no longer an Islamic republic, but they are a democratic, a secular republic. You know, so I think identities should not be taken as given and fixed, because they change. They are very context specific. They travel differently. Who we are different in different contexts and places. Which identity becomes most important where is related to our relationship with state, negotiation, power, communities. And is identity something so precious, you know, that we have to sort of keep it nurtured and protected? Because it cannot be. Because if we feel that it's something like this, then we are assuming that identities are ahistorical, whereas identities are not. You know. In fact, in the United States of America, like I, again, just like I did not know intersectionality, I didn't know this category Asian Indian American. So when they would ask me that, are you Asian Indian American? And I looked extremely confused. And my son, they declared, was Mexican, you know. So it seemed all very mixed up in the sense that, but there was this, I felt, and in fact that's something which is interesting, there was a great desire to immediately categorize who you were or where you were. But like I said, it's only when I went there, I realized it's a state category. And I myself in India would never define myself as an Asian Indian. I'm simply Indian, you know, whereas, yeah.
I have to say something about that because I talked before about the creation of this Pan-Asian category, and I think it kind of relates to this notion of classification of counting the, what's it called?
The caste census.
The caste census, but without collecting the socioeconomic. In fact, after World War II, there was a debate within the United States about, you know, ending counting on a sort of racial categories, which have been done for a long time, because of the kind of awful example, you know, of Germany, and in fact, Canada basically ended any kind of ethnic race counting. But with oddly enough, with the passage of equal rights, etc., then there had to be a census counting in order to sort of be able to document discrimination and inequality. So the decision at that point was to continue to count the categories. But then it became kind of more complicated as different groups tried to jockey to be included in groups that would, you know, kind of be covered by anti-discrimination law. One of the interesting things was that, in fact, in terms of Indian Americans, in 1971, this organization, and it was one particular individual whose name I can't actually recall, lobbied to get Asian, get Indians included under Asian Americans. So I think before that they had been classified essentially as white.
Brown Caucasians.
Yes, or brown Caucasians, whatever. But there's a lot of debate in some of these nationality things, because we, for a long time, until 1924, you couldn't become a naturalized citizen unless you were white or black, you know.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting in terms of groups trying to get themselves included. What's going on now is Native Hawaiians are trying to get themselves classified with Native Americans, with Indians, because there are a lot of special kinds of laws that, benefits that go with that. And also because they're very powerful senior senators from the state of Hawaii, Native Hawaiian identity trumps everything, because they want to maximize their count. So if you're Hawaiian and black, you're Hawaiian. If you're Hawaiian and white, you're Hawaiian. If you're Hawaiian and Japanese, you're Hawaiian. So so there's a whole politics involved. So at this point, it's kind of like the groups that are fighting for equality are the ones who are really trying to maintain the category. And there's also been a big fight over inclusion of a mixed race category, because a lot of people, you know, of course, are mixed, and they would like to be able to, quote, claim that. But the major civil rights organizations have opposed that, because they feel that it will just water down and reduce the number of African Americans if you just have a lot of people claiming multiracial. So it's kind of interesting that now it's the conservatives who would like to do away with this and say, well, basically we're a colorblind society. We no longer should recognize these categories. And it's the civil rights groups that are saying we need to have these categories in order to continue to,
to do justice.
To do justice and to, to collect the health statistics and all of those things. So that's an interesting kind of development.
It's actually this comparative studies one sort of really gets to understand, the dynamics in each. And there are common patterns which are there, but...
How does that intersect with gender? Is there any opposition that in census says we should not distinguish men from women?
No, there's not... In actual, this is what I was talking yesterday, the group which are demanding caste census are precisely the same set of people who are opposing the Women's Reservation Bill. So they have extremely conservative positions regarding women. And the deal with the state, like I was telling you yesterday, is we'll get the nuclear bill passed, provided you don't pass the Women's Reservation Bill and you promise us caste census. So this is the jockeying which is done, here. So the gender is very much there, This is the section which are claiming, wanting caste census. Yeah.
They're afraid that if the Women's Reservation Bill passed, that women from their own community would be given priority, as against men from their own community who have been in the political system for a very long time, that they will lose their own political positions to their own women. Mm-hmm. They're losing it to elite women first and then to their own women, which they don't want. And that's the reason why it's not passing.
Is it done? Yes, please.
I just wanted to say that as an historian, I really much appreciate your talk, because I also feel very uncomfortable with this notion and concept of intersectionality that are never used. And I think when you are doing historical work, you are faced with this kind of very complex situation and context, and you are always dealing with the diversity of in building the identities people are confronted with. And suddenly I realize that in your talk what did appear is that in that kind of class, class, gender approach, something is missing is the state. And the way the state is absolutely one of the major agents of the way to create what you are supposed to be as a person, as a subject. So the power, it's also a vision of the power and the distribution of the power that is implicitly present and that maybe we forgot and we have to work with. And it comes from your talk very
What you say is really helpful, because I'm always very little uncomfortable when you have a concept which, like identity, becomes a kind of fixed tool, So of course here, from a dominant all-white kind of perspective, you want to recognize diversity and you bring in intersectionality, which is very good. But again, it may leave out, you know, so you say, yes, all women are not same and women from different communities are different. But the problem is much more complex than just that, you know, because there have been actors like the state, different classes who have been jockeying, and not just the state, but the international institutions. So in our case, it was not our state, it was the colonial state, you know, who were intervening. I'll give you one more simple example. It was not just that they were categorizing in terms of this. They were also deciding what was moral and what was not moral. Indian notions of morality or sexuality before the British was very different. Like, we didn't have homosexuality being a criminal. It was the British who brought it out. And, you know, the question of possibilities of different kinds of sexuality was something which was recognized and accepted in people's lives, you know. There's a particular incident where you had a British colonial officer who had this Indian friend or Indian officer who said that there is a dance program, this was in Bengal, and I'll take you there, you'll enjoy yourself. So the Indian person took his British boss to show, and this British person watched this and came back horrified, saying that even the sex workers of London can't be more vulgar than these women, and how do you allow them to perform? And these were communities which were by community performers. There were singers, dancers, traditional beauticians who would go to houses and, you know, do up. And the state had so much power. This one individual's exposure to this made him bring about a law which banned these women from performing. And the Indian social reformer suddenly felt, okay, our customs are so vulgar. So they stopped these women from coming into the more elite homes where they came in as hairdressers and beauticians of their women, saying that these women speak vulgar language, and they tried to sanitize and there make their own wives more Victorian and proper, you know. Say the kind of clothes I am wearing, like this is called a blouse. We don't have an Indian word for it. Because obviously the Indian women didn't wear one. So it was only after the British came that they started wearing a blouse, you know. And we wear what is called a petticoat, you know, below, which is also an English word. And we don't have an Indian word for it, because very often you just didn't wear that. You just wore a loose cloth, you know. It was a very complex system. So on one hand, they were saving us from sati and widow remarriage, etc. On the other hand, they were bringing in new questions of, you know, their own notions of control and proper behavior and prudery. Yeah. This because, you know, I've always, and that's why my interest in the way we in the South look at Western theories, you know. And, I was just mentioning that one trip to the United States, and that was mid-90s, and postmodernism was very, very powerful. And everybody's talked about hybridity and fluid boundaries, and everything was fluid, and everything was just disintegrating. And I was very surprised, because I just entered through a very complicated, visa application there. And how fluid was all this? And I was also struck by, this this person who had led this movement against Sati was somebody called Raja Ram Mohan Roy, who's considered the first modern Indian. To talk about fixities, he was Bengali, the part I come from, but his first writing was in Persian, because Persian was the state language before the British came. So he was multilingual. His second was in Latin and Greek and English, and much, much later, at the last, when he knew that, yes, to be national, you have to write in your own language, his last piece was in Bengali. But he has this beautiful writing, talking about hybridity, is he has his memoirs, where he writes that, I have two houses, and this is early 19th century, 1800s. I have two houses in Calcutta. One house, everything is British. The furniture, the food, the decor, everything, except I. And he says, I have another house where everything is Indian, everything except I, you know. And this angst has been part of us, you know, that we've lived with it for so long that we got a little confused when we heard about hybridity, because we've been hybrid from day one. You know, we do not know but how to be. Where do we go? How do we go back? Is there a point where we can go back? Yeah. But to argue about questions of that, is it only about fixity? And the women's movement's position in India, and I think that's the right position, vis-a-vis the state, has been that it's double-edged. Yes, it's fixed us, it has categorized us, but yes, a democratic state also enables us, and we have rights as citizens. So I wouldn't like to end at a point where, no, not at all. I think, a democratic liberal state is empowering and enabling, and it is fixing. Yeah.
Modernity, growing modernity, and the attachment to some
identity,
some aspects of so-called Indian culture, which seem apparently in contradiction.
You know, India's entry, the story of modernity in India is extremely complex, because it was also regionally uneven. So in parts, like I give you the example of the person who's considered the first modern Indian, he is educated in Persian, Latin, Greek, English, Bengali, and many of them were. So they would write in the Indian languages, but they would mention about Bacon and Rousseau. You know, they were very cosmopolitan in their vision. And they understood modernity in the more Western Enlightenment tradition and were negotiating with that. You know, this is the of an earlier period. So the middle class, the educated Western middle class, which emerged in pockets of early colonialism, were rooted in the more fundamental premises of modern values and its more liberating aspects, and were familiar with the political philosophies, etc. There were parts of India which were not directly under colonial rule, which remained under the princes, Hindu and Muslim Nawabs or Hindu princes, and the British state had a deal with them, saying that, okay, you carry on doing whatever you wish to do, and we are not going to bother you with too much, except that we want your tribute or taxes, you know. And those pockets were areas where you had much less influence of Western ideas, modern belief systems here. And after 47, they were integrated into the state. So you have had pockets where you had universities, which in India are 160 years modern universities. You have five generations of Western educated people. And you have pockets where you've had great prosperity. I was mentioning the Green Revolution yesterday, and post-90s liberalization, which were pockets which were essentially peasant-based and feudal agrarian relations, who did not have a modern Western middle class, and whose entry into modernity is now, with consumer goods and malls, minus the Rousseau, Locke, and Bacon. So you have a different entry point. And their entry is that how do we become modern? We have beautiful houses, we have the latest car, we have gadgets, we fly and see football in London, we come back, and we burn our women. It's a very different entry, you know. And I think that's what I was mentioning yesterday, the clash between the older middle class and the newer middle class, because their entries have been differ by 100, 150 years in the same country. You know, in a certain sense, however, I would say the older modernity was more exclusive. So if you wanted to become a modern Indian then, you had to speak in a particular way, you had to carry yourself in a particular way. It had a lot of cultural capital invested. And for the newer modern Indian, you have to just buy your cars and buy your houses and buy your gadgets, and nobody would know where you came from. So it's more democratic and more inclusive in a certain sense. So it's a double-edged,
But at the same time, you kind of retain what you think is core to your own culture and your own tradition, in that you drive a Western car and do all the Western things that you can do. But at home, make sure that you eat Indian food and that your wife dresses in a certain way and your children are educated in a certain language. So it's a mix between modernity and extreme modernity, or what I would think is more extreme American consumerist culture, and very, very traditional practices which they don't want to give up and which they see as the only means to hold on to tradition and culture.
It makes me think of, we had recently in Geneva the CIDO session where India presented its report, and I myself, I was not present at that one, and I attended others, but there was one of our students who is a brilliant student from India and reivindicates being Dalit and having had a brilliant personal trajectory, who analyzed in a very interesting way and close to what you are saying, the discourse of the Indian government in reaction to the questions of the experts who were criticizing some things. And she was very shocked by the double discourse of the government. Sometimes he was really claiming that India was a huge and modern and rich nation and one of the first powers in the world. And when it was useful, he was claiming that they were a poor nation with traditions and so on. He was playing with those two discourses. But what I wanted to ask you is how would you feel about this CIDO convention?
I'm not so familiar.
After what you have said, what do you think about this?
I would not be in a position. I don't know the nitty-gritty details and which would be there, so I wouldn't be. But I know that there are reluctance on the part of the state and some issues and, there's always sort of bargaining which is taking place within the country, what could be accepted, what would not be acceptable. No.
So maybe, Magali, since we have stopped, it seems that we have finished, should we do the break now?
Yeah. Alors l'enregistrement, normalement, faudrait que je le